To continue really with the announcements for a moment, a number of people have been wondering, after the incorporation of the Intercontinental Church of God, about tithes and offerings. And we notice as the mail comes in that a number of people are making out the checks to the Intercontinental Church of God, and the majority are making them out to the Garner Ted Armstrong Evangelistic Association. All the things that Mark just talked about cost money. I got the contract for KLOR, and it is $16,800 for a year. The others are very close to that. Not all of them are going to cost that much, but for an example, if we had the money, we could be on WGN right now at an unearthly time in the morning, something like 5:30 a.m. Eastern time, which is unthinkable, if we had $4,500 every half hour per week. But it delivers that many people all over the United States, something like 374 cities and towns. I want to pass that along for the simple reason that the corporate documents of the Garner Ted Armstrong Evangelistic Association specifically spell out that it is for the purpose of preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God as a witness to the world, and its expenses are primarily with regard to the work. And that has to do with television and or radio, if and when. It has to do with, well, every check I've made out so far for the office leases and even for this meeting, I have not yet made out a single check on the very small amount of money comparatively that has come in for the Intercontinental Church of God. I have just written checks on the GTA Evangelistic Association. So all the booklets, Mr. Tony Brazil is here, and he's our printer. And for example, to print one of these major booklets, about 50 pages, costs about $2,700. And that does not account for anyone being paid. We don't even have a salary structure yet. I've just been paying a check now and then to people that are working very, very hard and very long hours, and it's just contract labor. So I want to pass along to you that the expenses with regard to the church are primarily going to be as follows. Reimbursement for ministerial expenses when ministers travel here and there and have to stay overnight or buy fuel or buy meals and so on to serve other churches. Hall rentals, we're already getting a little bit of a request for that. One or two places are trying to purchase their own churches and have simply switched them over to the ICG. We're going to be assisting with that as we can. So if it says church, it has to do with church, with the ministry, with the local churches, the conduct of the churches, visiting ministers and expenses and that type of thing. If it says evangelism, it has to do with preaching and teaching and the work going out over television, and that's where the big bills really are. So I wanted to explain that to people and to all of you along the way. Also, we don't want to prevent a single family from receiving this video that you'll be seeing shortly in a week as I am giving it to you. And hello to all of you out there. By the way, I'm talking to probably a lot of people, not just the group here in Tyler. However, it costs us approximately $5 per tape. And how many did you say are going out, Mark?
Over 170.
About 170. Just put a little calculator to that. Instead of 1,700, that is, let's see, $750, isn't it? Each time, every single week that I stand up here and preach, we've got to write out a check to the people that mail it out for $750. Also, I've been writing out checks for like $880 for some of the audio tapes. To package them and send them out. There's another little bit of good news. We have the Pitney Bowes Corporation. It's only about three doors down from us, and we've gotten them to come down and tell us about postal machines. And very, very soon now, we're going to be in the bulk mail permit, have that, and it's going to reduce our postage by about half. Actually, we've had to make out some pretty big checks to them for the equipment and to sign on to their system, but it will pay for itself in probably 6 months or so by the money that we save. Also, it will pay for itself very shortly by having bought two of the tape, the audio tape duplicating machines. We're probably going to have to buy two more because it takes a while. And right now, my son David is doing that, so we have that in-house. But there again, when we look at what we've been paying other people to do it, it's actually better if we buy our own equipment over a period of a year. We'll actually be saving money. So with that, those announcements to add to what Mark said. When I was a little boy, there was a vacant lot across the street, and a group of us kids got together and decided we wanted to form a gang. or a club. Now, there weren't any other gangs in the neighborhood, so I don't know why we wanted to do it, but little kids being the way they are, we wanted to get together, and we wanted to do something to kind of have a group or a unit. There was a vacant lot across 6th Street where we lived in Eugene, so we went over there, and it took a lot of labor, but with a shovel, we dug a deep pit about 6 feet by 6 feet and about 4.5 or 5 feet deep. And that's a big pit. We found a bunch of boards. We put the boards completely across and left a little spot where we could crawl down in there. Then we took all that dirt and shoveled it back over the boards and took sod and tried to hide it, as if people for the last week hadn't noticed these little kids digging this big hole out in the middle of this field. And then we got down in, and we got a place in a wall where we actually scooped out a bunch of dirt and got an old coffee can. We didn't have any money, but eventually I think we got a penny or two or three. And we put that in a niche, and then we managed to put a piece of sod and try to hide it, where we could have a little treasury in there. So then we ran around the neighborhood with a garbage can lid that we would put on our arm, and a little wooden sword or a long piece of stick like a spear, and Mama's maybe towel over the back of our necks as a cape, screaming and yelling and playing swordsman, and so on. And we wanted to be together, and I forget what we called ourselves, probably the West 6th Street Gang or something. But there weren't any other gangs, and we didn't go around marking territory and spraying graffiti and saying, keep out of our territory. We just were having a lot of fun. We wanted to make ourselves a name. If you'll turn to the book of Genesis in the 11th chapter, remember, Nimrod is mentioned in the 10th chapter as being the very first organizer of cities, and therefore, because he was led by Satan the devil, who was the very first politician in all of the universe, Nimrod was a politician. In the 11th chapter, you read about the Tower of Babel. The whole earth was of one speech, or one language, and of one speech. And it says in the margin that the, well, it's actually the same words. It says of one lip, or of few words, that they were a people that spoke the same language, and it wasn't divided at all. There weren't other dialects. It came to pass as they journeyed toward the east, or eastward, as it should read, as the margin says, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, that's modern-day Iraq, between the land of the Tigris and Euphrates River, called Mesopotamia, which merely means the land between the rivers, where you find modern-day Baghdad and Saddam Hussein today. And they said one to another, go on now, or come on now. Go to is a very awkward expression. A margin says, come on. Let's make brick and burn them thoroughly, where before they had always had just sun-dried brick. They were going to put these in a kiln and bake them. And burn them thoroughly, and they had brick for stone and slime, and the actual word is bitumen for mortar. Now, you know that Iraq and that whole area is very oil-rich, and bitumen is actually raw petroleum. It's a very thick substance, almost as thick as jelly or jam. It oozes out of cracks in the soil, and they could mix that in with sand, and it would actually harden and be a very good cohesive substance to help use it as mortar. They said, come on now, let's build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. It was falsely assumed years ago they were trying to get to heaven. Well, even the Babylonians weren't that stupid. They could look over there and see snow-capped mountains, and those snow-capped mountains were up to 12, 15, 20,000 feet. So it's a lot easier to go to the top of a mountain and then build a tower than to go down into a flat plain and build a city with a tower. So really what they were building was a skyscraper. Now, a skyscraper doesn't really scrape the sky, does it? That's an awkward term. In the Spanish language, they call a tall building in New York un rascacielos, because the Spanish verb for to scratch is rascar. You've heard of rasp, kind of sounds like it. Rascar, to scratch. Rascacielos, the word ceiling, seal. Well, cielos is heavens, heaven scratchers in Spanish for a building. What they were going to do is to make a great big tower, and they did, and apparently the relic or the remains of it have been discovered, and probably it had a form not unlike that of some of the church steeples in Austria, in Europe. I won't elaborate. They said, let's build a tower whose top may reach unto the heavens, and let us make us a name. They needed a symbol and a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Eternal came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord or the Eternal said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. If God had not divided the nations right then by confusing their language, man, by pooling his knowledge, would have no doubt entered the jet and then the space, and along with it the nuclear age and the age of biological and chemical weapons that can annihilate 20 worlds like ours many, many centuries ago. It was only after the Industrial Revolution, and really with the spread of English around the world, you know, because back by the time of just before World War I, do you know what the universal language was? It was French. In much of the world, the universal language among the cultured people, even in the Orient, was French. But eventually, with the British colonial empire, of course, and then after World War I, and especially by the time of World War II, English has gradually become the universal language in the world. But what divides languages? Well, primarily, distance, separation, geography. People in one island that can't reach another island 500 miles away don't even speak the same way. Mountain ranges, various certain topographical features like large rivers that are very much impassable, and of course the continents themselves and so on. So people speak different languages, and because they can't understand one another, they don't have a pooling of knowledge or information. And so you have one nation over here working on a particular invention. You know that in Russian textbooks they claim they invented the automobile. In Germany they claim they invented the automobile. In America we claim that we invented the automobile. And in this country we say that Orville and Wilbur Wright invented the first airplane. But in Russia they say they invented the first airplane. So history books are very different when you go from place to place. And they say and they allege different things. Just the last couple of days, we've seen now that a NASA probe, a very small little satellite that cost an enormous amount of money, is in lunar orbit. And they claim now that they've actually discovered like a frozen lake on the poles of the moon, on that part of the pole that doesn't ever get reached by the sun, so it wouldn't ever melt. They're already deciding what they're going to do with all that water. And they're already talking about actually a colony up there. Can you imagine living in some kind of a bubble tent with a gigantic big suit where you've got to take everything of this Earth's atmosphere, all of its food and its water and its oxygen along with you, and live up there in that kind of a climate to do what? Well, they claim there might be iron or nickel or other things up there. Who knows? Maybe even gold is on the moon. How are they going to get it back? How are they going to mine it? But man imagines what he is going to do. Way back in 1943 and 1944, the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico, was a site of some very strange goings-on. Up in the mountains above Santa Fe on a mesa, there was a project that got going in the last year and a half of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's life called Manhattan. And Dr. Robert Oppenheimer was the director of that program, along with several others who actually had been second-generation German scientists. But they knew that at the very same time they were working on a new device called an atomic bomb, so were the Germans at Peenemünde and other places up near the Baltic Sea in Germany. And they didn't know how far along they were. Time and time again, Santa Fe was rocked by explosions at night because they were working on the triggering device. It took them a very long time to develop it, but eventually they came up with the idea that a wedge of pure uranium and then a ring of pure uranium, suddenly one wedge, the wedge driven into the ring at great force by an explosion, would trigger what they call a chain reaction and unleash all of the energy in that uranium and create one of the most gargantuan explosions that the world had ever seen. It was all a matter of theory until they tested it out there at Yucca Flats. And my brother, Richard David Armstrong, remembers very well because he was in Las Vegas and actually saw the huge big flash. He wasn't out there where all the other people were, but he saw that at that time. What they did is, in effect, build a bomb with all the various components in it, which had merely a simple shotgun shell that propelled down a tube a wedge of solid uranium to wedge itself. It wouldn't quite go through the ring, but to just collide with that ring, and the two of them then caused that incredible fissionable explosion, the first atomic weapon. And it was called Big Boy, or Fat Boy, rather. Then they made another one, which was a completely different shape that they dropped on, because the science was progressing all the time, but they dropped on Nagasaki a little bit later on. Do you realize that only by perhaps a chance strike of the British RAF with their big Stirlings and Halifaxes on Peenemunde and some wayward bombs that they dropped, because even though they didn't really know how far along they were with their discovery of the potential of an atomic bomb, which was really underway among some of the German scientists even before World War II broke out. But if you read the story, A Man Called Intrepid, and you read about the man that actually put a bomb aboard a ferry where there were members of his own nation, and they were men, women, and children, because it was a shipment of heavy water that was going to go from Copenhagen over through the area there and then reach Peenemunde, and heavy water was essential in their research for a bomb. And that very courageous young man, who in a sense had to play God by deciding to sacrifice the lives of these people, blew the bottom out of that ferry boat and prevented that shipment of heavy water getting to Peenemunde. Do you know what would have happened? Do you know what would have happened if a Condor, which could have reached New York, one of the Hitler's big four-engine bomber, had dropped an atomic bomb on New York City? Germany would have won the war. We would have long since been speaking German in this country, and you know what we would have been? A nation of slaves. So just by these little things, where I believe God himself looked down and just made little adjustments here and there and changed this or caused that, such as a chance bomb that wrecked the program at Peenemunde, we are still free and still able to do the work of God today. When you look at what man has accomplished in the short span of time since Herbert W. Armstrong, my father, was played a joke upon by his father, who said, "Oh, quick, kids, come and look, there's a horseless carriage." Well, he's told the story many a time, and the children ran and they looked out, and there going by in the street was a carriage that was drawn by a mule. He loved to tell that story, but it illustrates the point that a car was so rare when my dad was a young boy that it was a phenomenon that the kids got all excited about and ran to see. Well, my father was born before the Wright brothers flew, and yet he lived up into his 70s and 80s to get on a G2 and to go around this world many, many times, and sat and watched on television as I did. I was down at Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy, when I saw them blast off to go to the moon, and I had flown a Falcon jet in there. We got aboard that Falcon jet and flew up to Orr, Minnesota, and went up to the home of Mr. Erickson and sat there. We had plenty of time to do it because of the amount of time it took for that missile to propel those people up into lunar orbit, and watched the first lunar landing up there near our summer camp at Orr, Minnesota. And here were men going to the moon, and it was the most inspiring, awesome, exciting thing that I have ever witnessed in my life, where you could see that giant rocket taking off and just shaking the ground and jingling the change in your pocket and seeming to beat against your chest with the shock waves of these millions of pounds of thrust, and knowing that man is going to the moon. When I first went down to Cape Canaveral, as it used to be called, or Cape Kennedy, with Lyle Christofferson, and I walked out there and I saw not one, but all those many launching pads. And I was there for the entire Gemini, Thor, Agena series of shots. And I was there for the first time where they launched one, and then they waited for the orbital pattern to be such that they launched another, and they were doing for future study the very first rendezvous in space, to get one missile to rendezvous with another, which now they're doing commonly. And we take it for granted. Every 90 minutes overhead for all of these years are literally hundreds and hundreds, well, they make a revolution around the Earth in 90 minutes, of satellites. And every 90 minutes overhead is the Russian spacecraft Mir, with Americans in there, and they dock, and they crawl back and forth, and they take supplies, and they pick up the garbage, and they come home. And we take it for granted. It's gotten to the point now where you miss the launching of the space shuttle, or its landing, oftentimes, because we are so accustomed to it. But you know what else they can take up there besides supplies? That isn't lost on the intelligence communities of any of the nations. And it isn't lost on anyone of the incredible accuracy with which missiles can reach their targets. Do you know how the United States people aboard those aircraft carriers out in the Gulf would know how to take out a particular building, even to go in a particular window of that building, if they needed to in Baghdad? Because carried in the pockets, if they want to, or the briefcase of every one of those UN inspectors they drive down the street could be a little GPS. It's actually battery-driven, a global positioning system. It is far more accurate than the navigational equipment we used in a Falcon jet back in the 1970s called inertial navigation. And those things cost $250,000 apiece. But you can go down to perhaps one of these, Walmart store, and buy a pocket GPS, which is accurate to within about 1 yard. And you can go out anywhere you want to, in the woods or out in the ocean or anywhere, and it will tell you by triangulation from various satellites, from a signal it's receiving, exactly where you are. All they've got to do is just punch a waypoint. They walk into a building, walk to that corner of the room, punch a waypoint, records it in a little thing, come back, give it to the military out there aboard those ships. They simply set it in the warheads of some of these guided missiles. They fire them off, and they turn at the intersection of 6th and Main, and go right on down and find the exact building they want and crash into it. This they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined, which they thought that they might be able to do. God stopped it then, but he isn't stopping it now. And now we have arrived at a place where the pooling of knowledge, and that is happening more and more as you see the Russians and the Americans are cooperating in space. All of Europe has cooperated with the creation of a European Defense Force, and even with Panavia, which is French, Belgian, German, and British, and with their building of these fantastically sophisticated fighter and bomber jets that they've used in the Gulf War. And every one of those aircraft, including even our F-16s and F-15s, are actually far better developed and further along today, as is the Israeli version of it, than they were at that time. Now they don't talk about smart bombs. Now they talk about brilliant bombs. Have you been reading that and seeing that in the news? They're talking about brilliant weapons now because they're far more advanced than they were at the Gulf, and you and I watched them on television flying right straight down the elevator shafts of some of the command and control centers in Baghdad. That's where we are, and that's what God said this world would come to if he did not stop it. Let's go to the 59th chapter of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah 59, this is one of my favorite chapters because it certainly tells us exactly what is going on in the world today. The governments of this world are all founded on the principle of vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed, but most especially the desire for power. When any one individual aspires to an office, his primary goal is not just money, usually, although it can be, graft, corruption, payoffs, bribes. We talked about that last week, and we know that all the way to the Senate and the Congress, and we know that some of them are actually doing jail time. We know that governors have been on the take, and they've been in jail and are looking at a prison sentence. We know that to the highest levels of government, there is corruption, which is why I've always thought it's better to have a multi-millionaire for president. For the simple reason, a man's got all the money he can ever want, and at least you know one motive is not there, and that's graft or greed or money. Other motives, power, etc., yes, they are there, very much so. Behold, the Eternal's hand is not shortened, that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy, that it cannot hear, but your lawlessness, your iniquities, have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, that he will not hear. God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, and your thoughts are not my thoughts, for as the heaven is higher above the earth, so are my thoughts than your thoughts. A lot of people have an opinion. They have an opinion about practically everything. I read to you a poem about a year and a half or two ago about how wonderful it is to be right. And when you talk to some individuals, you know that no matter what subject you bring up, that they are absolutely right, and there is not 0.1% room in their reasoning for them to be wrong, or to say, do you suppose I could be wrong about that? Most people are simply not that way. And so that is what really motivates an awful lot of people who want power, who want popular acclaim, and who want political office. Your hands are defiled with blood. Do you suppose there's anything to some of these stories that get out about a body found in a park with a gun in the wrong hand and no blood around? I don't know what to make of that, but then that's not something that I've really gone into. But Do you suppose there's anything at all in history about the two twins smothered in the tower, or about some of the ancient Caesars in Rome who actually murdered their own children, or about people who actually killed their own brothers, or about the, if you would read the lives of the kings and queens of England, and if you would read about bloody Prince Charlie, or you read about the czars of Russia, or you read about the purges of Adolf Hitler, you see, when a new would-be revolutionary comes along, whether you're talking now about a church, or whether you're talking about a political government, or a military organization, or any other power structure, he wants to overthrow the status quo. So he will begin to carp and to gripe and to expose and to, in any way he can, belittle this other person who is the ruler, who is in charge, and to show how utterly corrupt and awful he is. That's what goes on between Republicans and Democrats every 4 years in this country. And right now, festooning every lot in Tyler that doesn't have a building on it or all these placards and signs, all it has is a name there with maybe a check mark by it, so when you go in the voting booth, you might remember. Remember the purges of Hitler and Stalin? Remember the letter that the Germans actually got through their own secret service into the Russian high command? And because Stalin was so paranoid, he actually assassinated thousands of officers all the way to the level of captain in his entire officer corps that crippled the Russian army just as Hitler was about to invade. And it was called one of the greatest wartime intelligence coups of all time because the man was paranoid. Dictators, I talked to you last time about Saddam Hussein and his many palaces and his doubles and people who have actually been surgically altered and all of that, and that he can't sleep well at night and he has food tasters, and that he can't even be handed a piece of paper without it coming from a copier because he's afraid it'll be saturated with a chemical which would kill him by touching it. And so dictators are always paranoid. They are in fear of their lives and in fear of being overthrown. Your hands are defiled with blood, and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue has muttered perverseness. None calls for justice. What is going on right now in the media? It's about 6 hours a day. You can't avoid it. Your thumb gets weary, mine does, of clicking, clicking, and turning the remote because I'm so tired of hearing about Monica Lewinsky that it just clear up to here. But it's 50, 60, 80% of the news in the United States today, and you can't seem to get away from it. At least on the Internet, I can look for names that I want to find in Russia or other places, and I can get news sources that they won't give you on daily and nightly television. Now, because of the job that is being done on him, Mr. Kenneth Starr is being looked upon as one of the worst human beings that's ever walked the earth. But just look at these scriptures where God is talking about human physical governments. None calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. They trust in vanity. Now, vanity means a pursuit after wind. It means an empty pursuit after a handful of wind. You can't reach out and grab a handful of wind. There is nothing there. And vanity means emptiness, futility, and absolute worthlessness, and speak lies. You don't suppose that people in government would ever lie and conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. Of course, by analogy, they hatch cockatrice's eggs. Well, that's an awkward word. It means like an adder, a puff adder, and weave the spider's web. He that eats of their eggs dies, and that which is crushed breaks out into a viper. Their webs shall not become garments, neither shall they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity, and an act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. I know that it's Iraqi propaganda to say that Clinton would love to bomb Baghdad to divert attention away from the problems he's got here at home. I know that. But any other potential recipient of American bombs might come up with the same idea as well, not to give them one thing, because even though you might have a place in your heart for the poor, beleaguered Iraqi people, the man on the street, remember that he is a Muslim. And if, whether he is a Sunni or whether he's a Shiite Muslim, he would like to kill you and me. And he believes that we are the great Satan. Even though you don't want to see human beings, women and children suffer, and you don't bear any animosity toward them, but rather toward Saddam Hussein because he is an absolute bestial, maniacal dictator and a mass murderer, they make haste to shed innocent blood. Here was a man who was a would-be revolutionary. He and a friend of his decided that they didn't like the federal government. They had sat and watched just like I did, and I was aghast because we were in the office when that thing in Waco went up in flames, and I said, oh, no, and I was going by the main big workroom, and it was on right then, and there were those black clouds billowing up, and it was happening while I was watching. And while I was watching, there were women and children being fried and burnt to death in that building. Well, that clicked in the minds of a couple of people, and they decided that they were going to make a statement to the government. They, whoever they were, had hurt them, whoever they were, and these men didn't know them from Adam, but they did know that these people down there were a rather unknown, mysterious religious cult, and that the federal government had come in with the FBI. They'd actually got tanks and flamethrowers. They'd beleaguered them. They'd surrounded them. They'd played powerful music. They'd buzzed over with helicopters. We know that the first assault, there were actually some of the agents of the BATF killed, etc. So these people were so angry, and they caucused together like two little kids in a pit on West 6th Street in Eugene, Oregon, with a coffee can and two pennies in the wall. And they decided in their secret movement and in their gang that they were going to do something about it. We're going to make a statement. Well, it seems like they can't keep their mouths shut, so they just had to tell somebody. Timothy McVeigh told his sister. He said, there's going to be something big happening very shortly. Well, it was big, all right. It blew the Murrah building up in Oklahoma City completely apart, gutted it, and killed, what was 186, wasn't it, including twins and little bitty babies, and that's picture that we saw of the fireman with a shattered little body of a child. It meant absolutely nothing to Timothy McVeigh or to his cohort, who I believe will also be convicted of the crime. And I believe that there is no doubt of his guilt, and we will see what happens. But McVeigh is going to live the rest of his life, apparently, just watching television and having access to the library and the internet, and at least living life behind prison bars. They make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. Within less than 30 miles from where we are right now, there are people who believe in and are part of various paramilitary militia. And they like to get together every now and then in some remote thicket in East Texas or down in the big thicket by the Louisiana border and run around with old baggy camouflage clothing on. They are war buffs. They've never been in a war. Most of them never been near a war, but they'll go out there and pretend to march around and get their guns, and they will play war. They're getting ready to overthrow the United States government. And even though you might have heaved a sigh of relief when these two men who were part of the so-called Aryan Nation were arrested in Las Vegas about a month or so ago, carrying what was identified as anthrax, even though they later proved that apparently it was an animal vaccine. They were known to be advocating vaccinating various people against anthrax. Why? Do you know that in order to be vaccinated against anthrax, it takes 18 months? Do you know that it takes a series of something like 6 or 8, I forget, I looked it up and it's going to be in an article that will be coming to you shortly, shots over a period of about a year and a half? But the threat is right now. And, of course, now the Secretary of Defense has advocated that at least the troops in the Gulf be vaccinated for anthrax. Well, they won't be immune to it for another year and a half. What good is that going to do them? But that's where we are. So, of course, these people, in their absolute perverted, satanic desire to overthrow the government of the United States, as flawed as it is, as corrupt as it is, it's still the best government among human carnal men on the face of the earth. It's the best government that you know of. As flawed and as filled with corruption as it is, it's better, I believe, than the government in Thailand, better than the government in China, better than the government in Russia, better certainly than the government in Mexico, better than any government I know. The other day, my wife and I were looking at one of our table books. It's a beautiful book, and it's about Ronald Reagan. And it showed at the dedication of the Reagan Library, I believe six first ladies and 5 living presidents, all standing side by side. And I was just commenting to her what an incredible thing it is that during the election process, these men were taking tremendous shots at each other, calling each other every kind of a name, just fighting and struggling, saying he's absolutely a liar, he's worthless, he's no good, and so on. And here they were standing there together. When it's all over, when the conventions are over and all the confetti has been swept off the floor, and the ballot boxes have all been counted, and it's inauguration time. The guy who lost does not marshal all the Democrats or the Republicans and advance on Washington, D.C. with semi-automatic rifles. Instead, he says, congratulations, I will support you all I can, because he believes in the principles of the founding documents of the United States of America, and he believes in freedom and believes in our Constitution and of the United States, rather than his own personal egocentric desire for power. And when you looked at that and you say, here's the peaceful transition of power every 4 years in this country that it takes place, we ought to get on our knees and give thanks to God that we live here, because it's not that way in many other countries. Political opposition usually is assassinated, and sometimes, of course, when they get in office, and we don't really know the total story about that. I mentioned it in passing last week about Sam Giancana as to the assassination of John Kennedy, but we've had presidents assassinated in this country as well. The way of peace they know not. Is that an accurate statement? When you look at the governments of this world and look at what we have now done in the United States of America, and I'm not now catering to people who believe in militia organizations, but we have abdicated our sovereignty. We have given our sovereignty into the hands of a paper tiger that is one of the most ludicrous organizations the world has ever seen. From the very outset, the United Nations did not dare to ever appoint or elect as the president or chairman of the Security Council, or secretary, they call them, I think, the Security Council, a Briton, a German, an American, a Frenchman, a Chinese, a Japanese, or the member of any of the big powers in the nation, but instead they had to go to little Lilliputian countries around the world. So they started out with Iceland, and they went to Norway, they went down to Austria, they went over and got Uthant. So we've had guys like Trygve Lie and Uthant. Now we got this guy, Kofi Annan, from an African country. And we, the United States, with all of our bluster, and with all of our hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, probably tens of millions of dollars a day to keep all those men over there, over 25,000 troops, two carrier battle groups, over 20 ships, with all that it takes to keep them going over there, poised and ready to attack Baghdad. Because Annan went over and cut a deal. It was a kind of a deal we said we would never go along with, and came back and said, I've got a deal. Now the United States is afraid to act and has got to wait and to ask the United Nations to go along and to say, now you'd better behave this time. Now this time we really mean it, Saddam. Now this time, if you don't let our inspectors in there, we're really going to get angry, and it's going to have the severest consequences. Well, and they argued about severest. They thought maybe the word severe would be better. You believe that? But it's happened. They didn't want the word severest, some of them, because that sounds like war. How about just severe? Severe means we send you a nasty letter. So they argued about that. Now, finally, they did apparently go along with the idea of severest consequences. The way of peace they know not, and there is no judgment, discretion, no judgment in their goings. They have made them crooked paths. Whosoever goes therein shall not know peace. And Jesus Christ said, there shall be wars and rumors of wars. Therefore is judgment far from us, neither does justice overtake us. We wait for light, but behold obscurity. For brightness, but we walk in darkness. We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope as if it had no eyes, as if we had no eyes. If you go back to the days when I was a teenager, young boy, and you remember the Townsend Plan, you remember FDR and the proposition of Social Security. It sounded so good at the time. But many wiser heads railed against it because they said eventually it won't work. And sure enough, now, with a nation that is the biggest debtor nation in the history of mankind, that is actually what? It's far more than a trillion, but it would take you and your children and grandchildren, I don't know how many generations, to pay off the debt. And right now, the average American works from January through about June 16th to pay the government what he owes, and then the rest of the year he gets to work for himself. And they take all that money away from us. Now, that thing, who knows how long it's going to last, and yet an awful lot of people look forward to being able to receive a Social Security check. My sister lives on Social Security. I know and love many people who do. And if it weren't there, they would, who knows? I mean, if they weren't provided for by their families, if they're elderly and unable to work, they would be literally starving to death. They would be so destitute, they would be just probably dead. They wouldn't be around. But it isn't going to work in the long run. The governments of this world simply do not bring people what they expect, what they hope. They promise them everything imaginable, cradle to the grave. Popular acclaim at the ballot box says, we'll take care of you. We will give you free medical help and care. We will give you cradle to the grave security. We've got a safety net so if you lose your job, you don't fall through the cracks. You can go down to the unemployment office or some kind of a federal agency and get some money. We've passed laws now that if you lose your job, which affects me, that you can take your health care with you, except I've been thrown another left curve. I can't take my health care with me, apparently. Now I've got to go and apply for Medicare. I'm not quite sure how to do that, but I'll find out. But there was something that the government passed that said if you lose your job, you can have 18 months of your group health plan that will follow you along where you go. So I had paid about three checks back to the CGI, which they were then supposed to send into the health care people to keep the group insurance program going, but it doesn't include dental, and I need to have a tooth fixed. So that begins to become a little problem, especially when you're out of a salary. I started to say out of work. I'm not out of work. I'm not out of a job. I'm not unemployed, but I'm out of a salary for the time being, I hope. I want to turn back to the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel, show you where some of this got started and what God said about it. Samuel was an elderly old judge, and he was a very fine man. But he had a couple of boys that didn't follow along with the father. They were like a lot of other people we've read about in Chicago in the federal government. One was named Joel, and the other one was Abiah. Verse 3 of chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre. Oh, that money. That is a problem for us, isn't it? I've got to tell you, I every now and then will buy a lottery ticket. Now, I hope nobody leaves the church because of that. But if that thing ever hit, I'll tell you what I would do with about 80-90% of it. I'd be on such massive television, it would be, I would call WGN, I would say, I'll pay you twice what those people are paying you at 8 o'clock in the morning. But I'll tell you, people have asked me a question and said, well, do you think it is wrong to buy a lottery ticket? And I thought, well, if you're a person that is some absolutely so living so close that you can't afford even $1 with your birth date on it, don't ever do it. And I find out that some people become compulsive gamblers, and if you think you're going to win, probably absolutely crazy. But it's sort of like, you know, if I go fishing and I sit out in the boat, and I've got a handful of all kinds or a tackle box full of all kinds of lures, and I've got a rod and line, I just sit there and I look, and I wait for a fish to jump in the boat, probably isn't going to happen between now and the rest of my life. But if I've got my bait in the water, there is a remote chance that I might catch a fish. It might be very remote. There's a remote chance that I might get struck by lightning while I'm reading in my favorite chair. And that's equally as remote, and about as remote as if somebody won the lottery. But the other day, this gets you, doesn't it? Down in Uvalde in Texas, it was up to $45 million, and one guy won all of that. Blows you away a little bit. I don't look upon it as gambling. I look upon it as a complete loss of money. But this is different. They turned aside after lucre and took bribes, and that's commonplace in government, and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel and said, now you're old and your sons walk not in your ways. Make us a king to judge us like the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. Samuel prayed to God about it. And the Eternal said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, because God was leading Samuel, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now, therefore, hearken unto their voice. Howbeit yet, protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. The next several chapters are very interesting, and I read all the way through this entire story again this morning, and I would urge you to do so, because even after the king was chosen, God still said, all right, here's Saul, and if you will still obey God and won't stray from him, I will bless Saul, I'll bless his family, I will bless the country, I'll let you win the wars, and so on. But Samuel told all the words to the people that asked to have a king, and he said, "This will be the manner of the king that will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself." That's military conscription. "For his chariots and for his horsemen, he'll draft them into his army. And some shall run before his chariots like his palace guard. And he will appoint captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and he will set them to plow," as it should read, "his ground and to reap his harvest." He will put them like a group of slaves, actually, to just go ahead and be his planters, like on a plantation, "and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them. He will tax you to death. He will rip you off. He'll take away your ability to even earn a living and give them to his servants, his cronies." Look what Saddam Hussein does to his Republican Guard. He keeps them well stocked and nice places to live and booze and women. It says so very clearly in the intelligence reports. And of course, when you're having a meeting and you got about six or eight generals there and one of them disagrees with you, you simply pull out a pistol and shoot him and say, "Drag him out," and you continue on with the agenda, it gets people's attention. And Saddam Hussein has done exactly that. He has done that. "He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants." You know, Saul was a mild ruler compared to today. Because, see, in estate taxes, they take up to 90%. And depending upon your tax level, they take nearly 50%. And a lot of you are paying anywhere from 17 to 35%. But when you look at all the other taxes, the state taxes, the local, the school board, the county taxes, the hidden taxes, the gas taxes, the hotel tax, the luxury tax, and tax on every single thing you buy, you are paying oftentimes well more than 50% of all you earn in taxes. Saul only wanted to appropriate 10%. He could have been elected as a man who was propounding a flat tax. "And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants." Not just a tenth of their money. They were an agrarian society, so he took a tenth of all that they owned. "And you shall cry out in that day because of your king which you have chosen you, and the Eternal will not hear you in that day." Nevertheless, after spelling all that out and telling him how tough it was going to be, the people said, "Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may be like all the nations." For some reason, there is something about the snapping of banners in the breeze and the parading of 20 white palominos and the sound of the Marine Corps band and the stamp of marching feet. There's something about a stalwart man who is head and shoulders above all others with his great cap with the scrambled eggs on it, and he looks so powerful and so handsome. And when they chose Saul, it said when they found him that he came before them and Samuel anointed him king. And he literally stood head and shoulders above any other man in the entire kingdom. He was the tallest man in Israel at that day. And people just want to have a human leader to look to. They're looking, whom can I follow? Who can I adore? Who can I say is my human savior? Who is my ruler? Who is my king? Who do I want? I'll never forget the On the Street reporter, for I believe ABC, shortly after President Clinton was elected, and asked people on the street, "Why did you vote for him?" And this one lady said, "Well, I think he's kind of cute." And I thought about that if this is the way people vote to elect the most powerful man in the world who has the capability of launching an attack against Iraq or anyone else under the right circumstances, but, as they say, has his finger on the nuclear button. You know what happened when President Reagan went in and they found out that not only did he have polyps, but he actually had a little bit of a cancerous growth in the intestine. They had to remove a section about that long, remember? Before they put him under, they had to have the vice president completely away somewhere and the speaker of the house someplace else, and they had to make sure that that box that has the double key in it was secure and the entire nation geared up. Because when they put that needle in there and said, "Are you ready?" and then put the substance in there that completely made him go to sleep, for that time, the vice president was actually the president of the United States. until Reagan came back to full consciousness and awareness, there was actually a transition of government. And if we had been hit and attacked right then, it would have been up to the vice president to decide what to do about it. Because even putting him under in a hospital, and that's the way it works. They wanted a king like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. As I look around Sunday morning television, as I look at what has happened in God's church in these past months, as I look at people deciding where they are going to go, who they are going to follow, as I look at people for the, I don't know, umpteenth tiresome time, deciding they want to play church, and people talking about doctrines, and people arguing about the Bible, and arguing about how everything is going to be, and so on. I just shake my head and I say, here is Jesus Christ of Nazareth with these prophecies, the Olivet prophecy of Matthew 24 and Luke 21, talking about the times in which we live. And everything that I see in the news, these fantastic floods in not only Peru, but now in Ecuador. And in Peru, there is a huge lake, and I'm writing about that, that is 80 by 90 miles, that never existed before, a freshwater lake that is as a result of the torrential rains that have poured in there. And people all over this world, the terrible drought in Indonesia, the burning of the rainforest, the choking smoke that has flooded up into Malaysia and even to Hong Kong, shut down airports and caused children to walk around with cloth over their faces and is the equivalent of smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, according to health officials. As I look at the threat of the spread of everything from botulism to bubonic plague to scarlet fever to smallpox to anthrax, deadly VX, one drop of which can kill you if it drops on the back of your hand, and the fact that those things do exist, and that there are hundreds of gallons of them that have never been found, that they're trying desperately to find them before Saddam Hussein rains them down on Israel, and Israel is talking about retaliating against Baghdad with a neutron bomb, and talking about retaliating with atomic or nuclear weapons. And then, just 3 days ago, I heard that Paul Harvey said that a group of Jews, some small group of Jews, are going to begin building a temple, not apparently right on the Mount, but on the West Bank in Israel. And the West Bank is that portion, you know, of territory that was won by the Israelis in a 1967 Six-Day War that has been under such controversy. But that is another thing that gets my antenna up. As I look at the ravaging effects of El Nino on both of our coasts, and even here where we live, at this very early, mild spring that has come, with peaches all over one of my peach trees already, and it's just barely in the first part of the book of the month of March, as I look at record-breaking weather in every state in the United States of America, there is not a single state that has not had weather that has broken records since records were ever kept during this last winter in the last very few months. And then I look at God's church in disarray and people worrying about where to go, and people talking about getting together and ecumenism and having all these meetings, and apparently there are things in the wind that I cannot divulge to you now, but if and when it is corroborated, we will find out whether or not certain people are trying to merge together and to get all these organizations together, and apparently there is something like that that is in the wind. I have to come back to the time in which I live and to wonder, how much time do we have? Will we have time for 2 or 3 or 5 more feasts of tabernacles in a time of comparative peace, or will things begin to really blow up in our faces in this world, and will we be well into the Great Tribulation by 20? Or 2001, or 2002. And I can tell you, I would imagine, before too many more years are out, this world is going to be a very, very different place. And I don't think we've got that much time to do God's work. I don't think that in the old classic sense of the 1940s and 50s, of getting on radio and television, of advertising booklets, trying to write one booklet a month, trying to publish that booklet and get it out, trying to get a mailing list back anywhere near as big as the one that was just taken away from me of about 60,000, and we get elated when we hear we've just gone over 2,000. I know I am happy with that. That's great, and we hope we continue to grow and people find out where we are, but those 60,000, the bulk of them, don't know where I am. And they are calling in over there and saying, what happened to him? Where did he go? Well, we have no information on that. Do we have time to once again build to 100, 200, 300,000, 1 million. But the plain truth at one time grew to 5 million circulation, and I was in control of a budget of over $135 million per year. Are we going to grow to that size once again? I don't think there's time. So I think there's some other way in which God is going to cause a final witness to be given this country. And it is not going to be by a slow growth pattern of a work that gradually gets larger and larger, perhaps starts an academy or a college, and 20 or 30 years from now, then we're ready to give our big and final witness. No, I think a big and a final witness is going to have to be given within a very few years. And I cannot tell you right now exactly how I think God is going to do that. But eventually, if not through human beings, the great heavenly signs are going to show hundreds of thousands and millions of people who have heard a warning message and have tucked it away in the back of their minds and forgotten all about it. And then God is going to show them the truth, and they will know that the second coming of Jesus Christ is nigh, and is actually happening, and is very, very shortly going to come to pass. I don't think we've got another decade or two to warn this world. I think God's work has got to be done very swiftly and very suddenly. We will simply wait on Jesus Christ, leave the results with Him, and see what He intends to do to finish His work in our lifetime.